Welcome to episode 204 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be discussing Vail Resorts and what that actually means. And here's a spoiler, it's a lot more than just Vail. Vail Resorts is a company that owns over 40 ski destinations, now including both Andermatt and Crans-Montana in Switzerland. We're also going to be finding out more about skiing in Norway, this time focusing on the resort of Geilo. Now, my name's Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show regular guest Katie Bamber, online editor at Fallline Magazine. Hi, Katie. How are you?
Hi, very well, thanks.
Did I pronounce Geilo correctly?
You did, yes, that's it. Although I did hear some Norwegians calling it Geilo as well there. I couldn't work out. They seem to use both depending on accent.
Okay, well, it begins with a G. So I think my biggest advantage is I kind of got that the right way around. And also, for his first time on the show, joining us direct from Switzerland, we have Mike Gore, Managing Director of the Andermatt-Sedrun Ski Area. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me. A pleasure to see you both.
Excellent. Well, it is a pleasure. Now, you are in Andermatt in Switzerland. Can you see any snow out the window?
We have fantastic snow out the window. The skiing is really good right now.
Oh, well, you're making me very jealous, but I am lucky enough to be able to say that I'm going to be going out to Switzerland to Verbier next week. But one of the questions I always like to ask my guests is when you skied or snowboarded last. Let's start with you, Katie. When were you last on snow?
It was 2 weeks ago, kind of towards the end of February. I was in Engelberg. Beautiful snow on piste, not enough to do the best of Engelberg, which is the off-piste itineraries.
Right. Okay. Actually, my brother was in Engelberg last weekend, and he kind of had a similar piece of feedback to you. I mean, everything is in the timing, isn't it? But it's still beautiful to be in the mountains at any time. And in Engelberg, were you doing some of those off-piste runs guided off the top of Titlis?
I mean, ideally, that's what I wanted to do when I was there, but it hadn't snowed for quite a few weeks by that point, and it looked a bit sketchy, so I gave it a miss. But the on-piste conditions were seriously good, and because of Engelberg's, you know, situation and where it faces, it holds the snow quite well for the area, so that even though it hadn't snowed for quite a few weeks, it was pretty good.
Excellent. And Mike, what about yourself? Are you going to tell us that you went out skiing already this morning, because it is 10 o'clock your time by now?
I hate to admit I did not make it this morning, but let's see, Tuesday, day before yesterday, is the last time I skied. And today, as we all know, it is such a beautiful blue skies, new snow. So maybe I still get to ski today, but certainly over the next couple of days, I will be on the mountain again.
Well, we won't take up too much of your time this morning. Just tell me, how much fresh snow have you had just now?
So ending yesterday, we had, let's say over the past 48 hours, we had about 40 centimeters on Gemstock. But in the last week, we've had about 80 centimeters of new snow.
That is really good to hear. I can see possibly Katie's, you know, doesn't want to hear it like that, but timing, you know, is everything for the Alps. So that is really good news, because, you know, think about the industry as a whole. You know, we've gone through a few dry patches this season, so it's really good to know that there is snow coming down. And just from the snow report side of things, I've asked some of our regular contributors to send in an update from their areas. So let's have a listen to some of those.
Hello, Ian. It's Dave from Snow Pro Ski School, your number one favourite English-speaking ski school in the Port du Soleil and Villars. Hope you're doing well. This is version 2 of the snow report that I'm going to send you, because I sent you one yesterday and it was a bit... Well, the conditions have changed completely overnight. So here in the Port du Soleil and Villars and sort of surrounding areas, we have about, I don't know, maybe 10, 20 centimetres of fresh snow. So we're having a lovely morning this morning, skiing the off-piste, which is really, really cool. Yesterday, it sort of came down. It's been like freezing fog all week, really weird. And then late afternoon, it just had this kind of little dump of fresh snow. And it's been, I don't know, it's kind of light and fluffy. Temperatures have gone to like -1, -2 up here. And they've got the snow cannons on. So they're taking advantage of this kind of little cold snap here to kind of get everything ready for the final sort of push into the end of March and obviously into the Easter season. So everyone is not now seeing kind of, you know, green bits next to the piece and stuff like that. It's all gone white again. Snow conditions are really, really good. And over the next kind of week or this weekend or something like that, you're going to have an amazing time. So, and thank you again for all the good work you do. And I'll see you later on.
Ian, buongiorno. Good morning from the Val Gardena. Look, I'm going to tell you straight out, I feel like a fraud because I'm sitting outside my apartment. I'm 1,600 metres up the wall of the Val Gardena in wall-to-wall sunshine. There is one cloud in the sky. It's absolutely stunning. And that really belies the story of the last 2 weeks because, frankly, it's been pretty brutal, really. Yesterday, we had between 20 and 40 centimetres of snow. Cortina, definitely around about 40 centimetres of snow. But the last 2 weeks has been so unstable. One day to the next, you really don't know what you were going to get. And so warm. So some of the lower slopes have been absolutely brutal to ski, to be honest. But the good news is this fresh snow has freshened everything up. It was really cold overnight, and the outlook looks really good with fresh snow forecast over the weekend, and then we're into a more stable system. Dolomiti Superski are currently reporting 90% of lifts open. That's 409 of the 450 lifts are operating, and 1,257 slopes open. There are 31 closed for some reason. I've no idea why. We're heading towards the end of the season. Two official close dates, the 7th of April. Some areas are reporting that they're going to be open until the 1st of May. So if you're coming to the Dolomites, you're in for a great time. Slopes are fantastic. My name's Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy here in the Val Gardena. Ciao, ciao.
Hey Ian, it's Al Judge, co-founder and managing director of Alicats in Morzine. I am currently outside and you might be able to hear the fresh snow below my feet. And I wanted to tell you about the snow conditions. So this season has been a season of two altitudes. We've got above 13 or 1400 metres where the season has been pretty good. We've had fresh snow for quite regularly for most of the season, except for a period of probably 3 or 4 weeks where it got pretty warm, which was basically the month of February. And although it was warm, the snow has stayed, because there's been a good amount of snow on the higher slopes, it hasn't affected it too much. And what really hurts snow is rain, and we haven't had too much of that at those altitudes. So it stayed around, and then below 1,300 metres, it has been a much harder season. So that's the home runs into Morzine, so Peace Bee and Plenty, the Plenty Stad run, which come right into the centre of Morzine, and they're looking pretty patchy. And where we've had those warmer conditions, the snow has struggled to stay around. But for most people skiing the Port de Soleil, that doesn't, they're not pieces they ski on too often, so it hasn't really affected people's enjoyment and experience of the snow. This morning, however, we have snow at 1,000 metres for the first time in a few weeks, and the whole of the area is looking very wintry and white. And we're going to go skiing again this morning with the kids. Temperatures are due to stay cold, and there's a bit more on the forecast as well. So things are looking good for the rest of the season. We've got about 4 or 5 weeks left in Morzine, and about 7 or 8 left in Voreux and Chatel and the Swiss resorts. And it's shaping up to be a good finish.
Thanks to Tim, Dave and Al for those snow reports. If you are heading for snow, listener, then don't forget you can save money when you book your ski hire at intersportrent.com and use the code SKIPODCAST. You get a guaranteed discount for all ski hire in France, Austria and Switzerland. And to make it even simpler, you don't even need to use that code. You can just take the link in the show notes and your basket will automatically be reduced. And I would like to thank everyone who's used that code already this season. It means that I can keep producing these podcasts. And to be honest, I'd probably do it for free as I love it so much anyway, but it all helps. Now, a little bit of news. Team GB wise, Charlotte Banks won gold in the Sierra Nevada Snowboard Cross World Cup. So congratulations to her. She's having another really good season, started slowly, but is finishing really strong. What was really interesting to me was over in the men's slalom in Aspen, Laurie Taylor took 8th place. Now, that is his career best. So congratulations to Laurie. I was lucky enough to meet him when I was in Chamonix, which you can listen to that conversation in episode 200. He's been on the circuit for quite a while. I think he's very lucky to be working with Dave Riding, who came 7th in the same race. You can listen to our whole conversation in episode 200, but well done, Laurie. One final point on news. I listened back to episode 203, which is our Scotland special. I mentioned at the beginning of it that the audio was not as good as I would like. And that was partly to do with Amy's microphone, but it occurred to me afterwards that in some respects, it was a bit like skiing in Scotland itself. It's not always perfect, but it was definitely worth it overall. Right, we're going to move on to Vail Resorts now. I'd like to welcome Mike. It's lovely to have you on the podcast. I know you're in Andermatt now, and I can tell by your voice that you're probably an American. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about your background. I think I read somewhere that you're at Park City prior to Andermatt. Is that correct?
That's correct. Been in the industry for over 40 years. I've worked for Vail Resorts now for quite a long time. So let's say over the last 12 years, I've managed resorts primarily in the western United States for Vail. I oversaw the Keystone Resort in Colorado for a number of years. I managed our Lake Tahoe region, which includes Heavenly, Kirkwood, and Northstar resorts in Nevada and California. And I've been at Park City actually on two different occasions as the chief operating officer. And that is where I was prior to coming to Andermatt-Sedrun. Park City is one of our large resorts, of course. It is the largest ski resort in the United States.
Now, I'm sure all of our listeners will have heard of Vail, but Vail Resort is much more than that. I think it was in 1997 that Vail Resorts was actually formed. Which resorts were in that group to start off with?
Yeah, so in the beginning, in 97, there was just the Vail Mountain, which is our flagship or namesake, Beaver Creek, Breckenridge, and Keystone. But importantly, I should share that Vail Mountain, of course, was founded in 1962. It was a small resort, of course, in the very beginning, just two chairlifts and a gondola. And then it was in 1997 that the company went public. And so that's kind of the date that ties back to Vail Resorts as a publicly traded company.
That was when Vail Resorts started as a group. And I mentioned in the intro that the company now owns over 40 ski destinations. I think that people are probably familiar with that idea, but they will also have heard of the Epic Pass. And I think that launched in 2008. And this is one of those passes which you can buy that allows you, the different options within it, but that allows you to get access to lots of different resorts in the group. There's a few passes like that now, but I think at the time this was the first, and it was really a real innovation. What prompted Vail Resorts to launch the Epic Pass?
Certainly my favorite topic to talk about as it relates to Vail Resorts. I mean, it really is foundational to our company, the history of our company. If I can say it, in many respects, it revolutionized skiing. It provided greater access to more people, greater value, more affordability. You know, when we launched the product, and you're correct, and it was in 2008, perhaps more than one person said they thought we were crazy to have a product like that. But passes were very costly. Annual or season passes were really quite expensive at the time, even going back, you know, 16 years ago. We felt that there was a pass product that would, again, make skiing more accessible, of greater value, and overcome some of the challenges that we face as resort operators and as consumers with the unpredictability of weather and resort openings. So the concept of the Epic Pass, in addition to providing greater access, more affordability, greater value, was a commitment from the consumer to purchase the pass in advance. That takes out predictability for us as a business. And in return, the consumer gets a tremendous price, a tremendous value, and a network of multiple resorts. Certainly, in some instances, if resorts are not, if one resort doesn't have great snow, though it may require some travel, you may have opportunities to go to one of the other resorts on the Epic Pass. And so it locks in our dedicated skiers and riders to the Epic Pass. It allows us to have a consistent revenue stream, which has allowed us for consistent investment back into the resorts, creating this experience of a lifetime that we often talk about. And that's how we do it. We have a consistent, reliable reinvestment into the product, into the experience, and our guests benefit from that. They're loyal to Vail Resorts. They ski a lot because they have an annual pass. And I just think it works. It's really tremendous in every respect.
Yeah, well, I can certainly see how what you talked about there, making it value for money, is the case. If you're someone who's skiing on a regular basis and you have access to a lot of the resorts, or indeed, you know, and I know a lot of Americans travel across, you know, from coast to coast in America as well, then it represents a good value for money. But also, there's a real advantage to Vail Resorts as a business as well in terms of cash flow, because it's bringing that money in at the start of the season as well. And this is always a challenge for any resort to be able to handle these areas. So in some ways, is it a hedge against, let's say, a bad weather season as well?
That's correct. It's a very accurate statement. Ultimately, the other benefits of that, I guess I would say, is it creates more stability for the employees, for the communities, and certainly more stability in our capital investment. As you say, we have this revenue stream in the beginning that allows us to continue this investment.
You know, we started off by saying it was a group of American resorts, initially Vail Resorts. But, you know, more resorts have been added, and it's now an international operation. You added Perisher and Whistler in 2016. I was actually out in Perisher last summer. And, you know, all of my correspondence in advance was with employees of Vail Resorts. How many countries and resorts are now within that Vail Resorts group?
You know, we operate now in four countries: Canada, U.S., Australia, as you said, and of course, Switzerland. Crans-Montana, which we're just working through the final details of closing on the acquisition of that resort. But that will be number 42 across those four countries. And those resorts are made up, as you know, of very large destination resorts, as well as more regional and local resorts. And I would say this, the passion of the skiers in those local regional resorts is amazing. And what do they like to do? They like spending their weekends at their local resort and then figuring out how to take a ski or ride vacation to one of the bigger resorts in the network. And so works really well together, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, if you have your Epic Pass, it makes sense to try and get as much value out of it as possible. And, you know, you mentioned Crans-Montana, and we'll come on to that shortly. You're in Andermatt right now in Switzerland, and that was the first European resort to join the Vail Resorts group. I wondered how you identified Andermatt. What is it in particular that made that particular resort work for you?
You know, I would start by saying we've been quite public about our desire, our strategy to expand to Europe. And so we try to have conversations with resort owners, operators in Europe, and see where those opportunities might lie. Andermatt-Sedrun was an opportunity, as you know. It's gone through quite a significant development over the last several years. And so our partner in Andermatt-Sedrun, Andermatt Swiss Alps, who started the recreation and evolution of Andermatt-Sedrun, felt that we were a good partner. We felt they were a good partner. It really was a great relationship that fairly quickly came together, that we both brought strengths, expertise to the ongoing development and further creation of this very special destination of Andermatt-Sedrun. We are fortunate enough to have really strong relationships. We've been so well supported by the community, by the government, and our employees in Andermatt-Sedrun. So it's worked really well. We saw it as a great opportunity for our entry, and it has tremendous potential.
Yeah, I mean, I've reported from Andermatt on the podcast before, and I'm a big fan of the resort. It covers a lot of areas. It ticks a lot of boxes. You've got, you know, tremendous off-piste backcountry skiing on Gemstock that you mentioned. You've got really good piste skiing. You've got a real mix of properties from the top of the range, good quality new properties, and the older kind of village as well. But it's also kind of interesting that part of that business there is, well, I suppose it's property development. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the history of the resort, and it went through, it was incredibly important strategically, historically. And I'd encourage listeners, I'll put a link into the show notes for my previous coverage of Andermatt, but very important strategically. And then when the Swiss Army left the resort, it kind of went into decline. And more recently, an Egyptian businessman went in, saw the opportunity there and started developing it in terms of a property. And was it the property side of things? Is that an important factor in it as well? Because there's a lot of development going on there.
It absolutely is. It is an important part of it. It speaks to potential and the future growth of the destination. And so Andermatt Swiss Alps have just done an amazing job in what they've created here, what we refer to as the prime alpine destination is our objective. And it is a high level of guest experience, beautiful accommodations. And I have to say, as importantly as all of that, it's to maintain the unique culture, charm, this destination, the historical significance of Andermatt, as you mentioned, it's been through an evolution with the military being such a presence and then leaving. And so it's now in its next phase, if you will. It's incredibly exciting what has already happened in the future.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned, you know, the community. Obviously, you've lived, I'm thinking, most of your life in the States. Now you're living in Switzerland. How are you finding living in Switzerland yourself, Mike?
Well, I love it. I've traveled to Switzerland in the past over the years. And this was quite a special opportunity for an American and the opportunity to come join the team here. And it is an amazing team. So that's made things very nice, much easier, if you will. And I love living in Switzerland. And my wife, Heidi, would say the same thing.
You know, I can understand that. I mean, you know, I've been to Andermatt, spent a lot of time going to different resorts in Switzerland, and regular listeners will know that for several years, Switzerland Tourism was sponsor of the Ski Podcast. It gave me the opportunity to discover lots of places there. And I love Switzerland in winter and in summer as well. I wondered, Mike, if I could then move on. You mentioned Crans-Montana before, and I know that Crans-Montana, that deal hasn't completely gone through yet, but it will become the 42nd resort to be part of the Vail Resorts group. What made Crans-Montana the next right choice for you?
You know, we've talked a little bit about mountain communities. You know, what do they bring to the network? Like, how does it strengthen the overall network and what our guests can experience? Crans-Montana also has an incredibly rich history, very well known for the skiing, the activities, the other events, special events, a very well-known resort. Ownership there had decided that may move on to other things, and it opened the door for ongoing conversations. And as we looked at it, we just felt it was a tremendous fit for Vail Resorts. And again, our strategy of expansion in Europe, we think that there's great opportunity there as well. And one of the things I would say, we come in as not the expert, but one of the experienced operators of ski resorts, and both in Andermatt-Sedrun as well as Crans-Montana. They have tremendous expertise in teams. How do we add to that in terms of resources and our own experience and be a really strong partner in the community? That's how we went about it here, and that's how we're going about it in Crans-Montana. And I think it's got a very, very bright future.
Well, I'm a big fan of Crans-Montana as well. Again, I've been lucky enough to be there several times. I love, in particular, the ski touring routes that they have there. But I'm going to be going there in September as well to do a trail running race. So again, winter and summer, there's a lot to offer there. I'm thinking that the deal in Crans-Montana is a bit more complicated than Andermatt, because in a sense, Andermatt had perhaps, you know, one owner to deal with, but you've got a lot of different stakeholders going on in Crans-Montana, the lift company, restaurants, hire shops, etc.
I don't know if I would say it's more complicated. It's different. It's a different process, but each of our acquisitions typically are. There's always some unique elements to the acquisition. I think this one has gone quite well. The sellers and community have really been supportive. They've been really good to work with. And so these things, they do take time. They're always complex. We feel very good about how this thing is progressing. And while we never have an exact date when the closing on the acquisition will happen, it's tracking well. And I know we're getting close to it. And so, yeah, really good partners. And I think it's going to go well.
Just out of interest then, I mean, what kind of, once Vail Resorts are the owner for Andermatt and Crans-Montana, what kind of changes, if any, do you think skiers and golfers, for that matter, it's another interesting connection between those two resorts because they both have excellent golf courses.
Yeah.
What can they expect to see?
We start every conversation, if you will, in terms of what are we going to do at a ski resort? We answer this question, what can we do to enhance the experience for our guests? That typically happens in the areas of upgraded lifts, upgraded snowmaking, and an upgraded snowmaking system is not always or only capacity. Often it's upgrading to, in terms of technology, to make sure we're making snow with the least amount of water and the least amount of energy. That's always a priority as we come into a resort. And then gastronomy overall, what are the restaurants offering? What changes would enhance the experience for our guests? And then technology in terms of how do we make things easier for our guests to move about and enjoy while they're in the destination. And so it's guest experience. Experience of a lifetime starts every one of those conversations.
And, you know, you've mentioned in our conversation so far the phrase strategy of expansion, I think, in Europe. You know, is this part of building the Epic Pass product to build in solutions for U.S. demand for European skiing?
In part, it certainly adds to the overall network. And we see and will continue to see more and more North American skiers and riders visit Europe. But we're also working to build the network within Europe. And so European Epic Pass holders, obviously, it's an important element of our expansion in Europe is to create that network within Europe.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I can see that if, for example, you have someone in Europe who's thinking about that holiday to the States, maybe, you know, classically, it might be a road trip or the opportunity just to ski in the Rockies for the first time, and they're skiing in Europe, then they have a greater incentive to buy an Epic Pass where they could cover, you know, holidays in both places within a single pass. So thinking ahead to that strategy of expansion then, will there be more acquisitions? Because I've heard some strong rumors that there's been negotiations with Verbier, where I'm going next week.
So I can't speak to, you know, rumors, obviously, or speculate on those. I will tell you, though, there is always a rumor about what resort is next, and we treat them as such. But as I said, we are intentional about the strategy to expand in Europe. And so we will have conversations with the right type of resort, the right location for a resort, et cetera. Now, Verbier, that I, of course, heard the same rumor. To be candid, it's just in a long list of rumors of resorts. What is different, though, about Verbier, and what is we're very proud of, is they're on the Epic Pass, as you know, and they have been for a while. They're a pass partner with us. And so that's wonderful that Epic Pass holders can ski at Verbier. That's pretty special.
That is really interesting, and well done for handling that question there about, well, rumors are rumors, aren't they? I wondered if I could just finish off by highlighting, you know, Vail Resorts' commitment to sustainability, because, you know, I tend to do my very best to feature good examples of sustainability on the podcast. And you referred earlier to, you know, having efficient methods of snowmaking. I read recently that you've hit your goal of 100% renewable electricity for the second year in a row. Does that apply to all of the resorts in the Vail Resorts group?
It applies to all of North America. And we're working on achieving 100% across our entire network. So yes, 100% in North America. We're ahead of our stated goal of reaching 100% net neutral or net operating, zero net operating footprint by 2030. We're ahead of schedule in every metric, and I appreciate you bringing it up. We are committed to this. It's been a priority in our company for many years, and we truly feel an obligation. It's the right thing to do. We are passionate about it. Our employees are passionate about it. We live, operate in the outdoors, and we should be doing all we can to protect the environment and sustain all aspects of our life. And we certainly want to do our part to take care of those resorts where we operate.
Well, that's really interesting to hear, Mike. And I know in Andermatt as well, again, I'll put a link into the show notes, but I've featured a lot of the sustainability within Andermatt itself, which ranges from how the resort is heated and how the lifts are run. And I know there's wind power in that area as well. But I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast today, Mike. Really interesting to hear more about that. And maybe I'll have you on next year when we talk about the acquisition of Verbier or whoever else that might be.
That's great. Right, well, thank you so much, and I'll see you on the slopes at one of these resorts.
Yeah. Right, that's brilliant to hear from Mike there. Now, Katie, we're going to move on to you now, if that's okay. I managed to pronounce Yalo correctly. Episode 201 was a Norway special, but yeah, a whole country. There's absolutely no way that we can cover everything. We looked at a few resorts there, Gaustad, Stranda, Fjellsetra, if I've got my Norwegian correct. But I'm really pleased that we've been able to get you on today to talk about Yalo. When was it that you were there?
I was there mid-January. So I arrived on the 15th to minus 15 temperatures.
Minus 15. Okay. So just give us a sense of, where we would find Yalo within Norway. Where is it in relation to the main access areas?
So it's pretty far south in Norway, like a lot of its main ski resorts. It sits on the main road between Bergen and Oslo. So 250 kilometers between each. So it's really easy to access from both airports. The train line that goes from Bergen to Oslo is one of the top 10 in Europe as well for how good looking it is.
Okay. And so is it one of those carriages, a bit like the ones in Switzerland, where they kind of have lots of extra glass put in to allow you to admire the mountains as you're going along?
Well, actually, it was the first time I'd visited Norway when I went in January, and I was on a Crystal All-In holiday. So I actually got a very slick coach from Oslo, which is where I arrived to. But next time I'm definitely planning a road trip or a rail trip, which is really easy to do in Norway. So I'll let you know then.
Okay. And how far was it then from Oslo to Yalo?
So that was, it's probably 2.5 hours drive on a big bus with a stop in the middle.
When we discussed Norway before, one of the things that became apparent is we're not talking about the kind of altitudes that you have in the Alps. The mountains are lower, but you're often going down to a pretty low level. What sort of altitude is Yalo? What's the vertical like there?
Yeah, so Yalo village sits at 800 meters and the skiing goes up to 1-2, just below 1-2. So the vertical's really small, but like I said, Norway's climate is much drier and much colder, so it doesn't affect the snow at all. In fact, it's snowshoe as you get at the moment.
And so what kind of resort is it in terms of what it's offering in terms of runs?
So it's got, so Yalo has two sides of the mountain. The village sits in the middle. There's a gentler side. I wouldn't really call it a beginner's mountain because it's still pretty big and it's got a red slope on it and, various blues and some seriously good terrain parks as well. But it is the gentler side of the mountain. And then on the other side, its highest altitude is 1175. So that gives you 250 meters vert for one run, which is pretty short compared to lots of alpine ski resorts. But it also means short chairlifts, where it's extra cold, you're not sitting on a chair for as long.
And so that other side of the mountain, are those the kind of slightly steeper runs relative to that, sort of beginner's area?
Yeah, there's a World Cup slalom run, which is a lot of fun. And then on the far skier's right of that mountain is, what's the mountain called? It's called Yalo Hovda. It's the slightly steeper mountain. There's one black run there.
Any off-piste that you were looking at?
Well, like I said, it was it hadn't snowed for a week or two when I was there, so I didn't do any off-piste. But, it's a well-established family resort. But It does have a lot of apres because of its proximity to both cities. I hear the apres at weekends. I was there from Sunday to Wednesday or something like that. So it was completely empty, the slopes. I saw a couple of people a day at that. It was amazing. But at weekends, I think the attitude changes completely and everyone comes in for a huge kind of like, you know, a little bit of skiing and a huge amount of apres.
Okay, well, you mentioned that, Bray. You brought it up there. And something that cropped up when we were talking about Norway in episode 201 was the cost of apres, let's say. You know, Norway has this reputation of being quite expensive. Were drinks, you know, affordable? Could you have a good apres night out in Yalo?
I think that's it. I think Norway has a reputation for being really expensive, but it's kind of almost exclusively just the alcohol that's more expensive than any other country. You know, I found the restaurants to be the same. The food and the lift passes are pretty much the same as any, you know, mainstream resort in the Alps. I think I just calculated, I was just looking at my bank statement and the beers were coming out about £9, which is a fair bit more than you'd want to pay. Although, to be fair, I've paid that much in London recently.
We know that that is possible, but £9 for a beer, I guess, is always going to be considered expensive. But like you say, you've got to take into account all the different aspects of it. I mean, some people, when they go to Switzerland, or Switzerland has this reputation of being super expensive. But in my experience, it's not generally particularly different from a lot of the big ski resorts in France, etc. Lucy, when she was on the show talking about Gouster, was talking about late lift openings. You know, she was saying she turned up to go skiing and the lifts weren't opening until 10 o'clock and there was quite a bit of night skiing. Does that exist at all in Yalo?
Yeah, it was the same. There's at least for two of the nights I was there was night skiing on each side of the mountain, one night on the Jailolia side and the other one on the Hovda side. I think lifts opened at 9:30, but it stayed dark until pretty much 9:30. I mean, it was perfectly light enough to ski in and the floodlights were on for a bit of it, but it just cast, that cold light cast the most beautiful light over the mountain to ski in. You know, it's kind of like pinky coloured and golden.
I have skied at night only once under floodlights, which was in Kutai in Austria. The visibility, the vision is slightly different. Well, I guess it's obvious that it's different from daytime skiing, but you found that okay?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the night skiing was great and there's more than, you know, normally you just get one run in a ski resort that's open for night skiing, and in Yalo it had several floodlit runs. Yeah, it was a really cool element to it. In fact, runs might be short and not that steep in Yalo, but the other activities you can do when you're there is, you know, vast. Night skiing, just one of them. Norwegians are quite big cross-country skiers, but there are 550 kilometres of cross-country trails. There's a lot of fat biking, ice fishing, ice swimming. I mean, for families, and not just young families as well, the activities are kind of endless.
Right, you're saying ice swimming. I presume, Katie, you tried it then. You launched yourself into the lake, did you?
I did. I didn't do it in Yalo. I actually did it in Oslo. So I stayed an extra couple of days in Oslo afterwards, and you can do the whole sauna into the water there, which was cool.
More than cool, I should think. Very cold. What temperature was the water there?
Good question. I don't know, actually, but it was extreme.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting into the sea here in Brighton generally on a weekly basis, and currently it's about 8 degrees Celsius. I'm imagining it's got to be much colder up there. How long are you in the water for?
Well, down in Oslo, just seconds and not all the way under. I never thought you could really feel the difference between like 5 degrees and minus or whatever, but you really can.
Well, very, very cold. And you're saying in Yalo, there's the opportunity to do that very, what we would think of as a Scandinavian type of thing, to get really hot in the sauna and then throw yourself into the snow or into the ice cold water.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't actually check it out. There is a big, I don't know if it was a body of water. I'm not sure if it was a lake or a river, but it was completely frozen over and snowed on, so you could hardly see it. But I know they cut holes for fishing in it.
So you mentioned about the cost of apres ski. What about the actual cost of getting there and the opportunity to visit other resorts as well?
So I looked this morning for flights if you wanted to go independently, and return flights to Norway for March and April, so pretty last minute, are looking at 150 return, which is not bad. And then if you wanted to go from Bergen to Voss or into a ski resort by train, it's looking about £25. So a lot less than I assumed it would be. And then I was staying in it felt like 5-star, but I think it looks like a 4-star, all in 7 nights with flights and transfers and lift tickets included, was £1,500 a person for a week.
I mean, that sounds very good for a 4-star, feels like 5-star property.
Yeah, absolutely. I was like pleasantly surprised. I kind of just heard the rumor that Norway was expensive. And apart from the very good, very strong local beer, you know, it surprised me.
So you're saying then that you could look at potentially, you know, going back and having a multi-center holiday. So you were in Geilo just then, but, you know, Voss is the biggest ski resort in Norway?
Geilo is the most established and the oldest, with a huge amount of recent investment in 2017. Voss, I've heard a lot about, I haven't been, but it would definitely be on my radar. Norefjell, just down the road, I think it's only an hour. It's got 3 times the amount of vertical and is a lot more famous for off-piste skiing. And then, of course, you can do, you know, the most pictures most people have seen of skiing in Norway is in the fjords further north. So Narvik or somewhere way further north is definitely on the radar as well.
Well, I know you like to check out the backcountry, Katie, so I can imagine you going back there to explore further. Well, that's brilliant. Thanks so much for sharing all of that about Geilo. And, you know, listeners now will have heard a lot more about Norway in the last couple of episodes. And it is really quite interesting how there does seem to be this sense that more of the British market are heading there. Now, we're going to move towards the close now. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Had a couple of bits of feedback since the last episode. Kostas Doudoulakis, apologies if I've just mangled your name, Kostas. He said, thank you for the inspiring content. I first started listening to podcasts during lockdown. We're now ready to take our first ski holiday with our 4-year-old. And I partly attribute this to the enthusiasm you managed to convey with each episode of the podcast. It's brilliant listening to someone who has such passion. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Kostas. I appreciate it. We also had a review on Apple Podcasts from Grant. He said, love this podcast. It covers a wide range of ski subjects in lots of detail. It's a must listen. Thank you, Grant. And there was also this review on Apple Podcasts, which I thought was really interesting in relation to our conversation with Mike. Unfortunately, it's from Anonymous, but it says, I am a listener from the United States. I follow several ski-oriented podcasts. I enjoy the Ski Podcast due to its wide geographic area of focus. And I'm fascinated to hear the perspective of the primarily British and European hosts. Having had the opportunity to ski in Switzerland, I greatly enjoy the differences in the ski culture there compared with what I've grown up with in the States, just as I enjoy the wide range of topics covered by the podcast. So Anon, whoever you are, thank you very much for that. And probably you'll find this episode even more interesting where we're looking at that blend between Europe and the States. So finally, listener, if you enjoy the podcast, there are 3 things you can do to help. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That helps listeners find us. You can subscribe. That means every episode will automatically be downloaded for you, so you can catch up at your leisure. And you can book your ski hire with InSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or just take the link in the show notes. There are now 209 episodes to catch up with. 144 were listened to in the last week. I've mentioned before that Ski Podcast is usually in the top 10 in the Apple Podcast chart for Wilderness, that's our category. And I am really pleased to report that last week we hit number 1 in that chart for the first time, finally beating all of those cycling podcasts that are normally ahead of us. So I'd like to thank all of our listeners, wherever you are in the world. In the last week, 56% of you were in the UK, 16% in the USA, and the rest of you across the rest of the world. I see we've had listeners in the last week in Argentina, India, Laos, and Saudi Arabia. So wherever you are listening to this podcast, listener, thank you for giving us your time. There's so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank InSport for sponsoring the show and thank my guest today, Katie.
Thanks very much.
And Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally, listener, thank you for joining us. And until next time, goodbye.